When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello and welcome to Behind the Lines. I'm Arthur Snell. Before we get started, I just wanted to tell you about a new podcast presented by my friends Jason Pack and Alex Hall-Hall. Here's a little taster of their latest episode.
If you actually want to stop an armed conflict, it's no good saying you're not going to talk to the people with weapons, because they're very unlikely to make peace if you don't talk to them. So you find yourself negotiating with people you really don't like.
From the Middle East to Ukraine, if we want to figure out a way out of these seemingly endless wars, the ability to negotiate is crucial.
And so in this week's episode of Disorder, we're talking to Jonathan Powell. He was one of the key people responsible for negotiating the Good Friday Agreement.
I was met by a Northern Ireland office official who told me the biggest bank robbery in world history had happened the night before. The IRA who'd done it. I felt like getting back to London, but I had a little theory that once you've got a negotiation like that going, you've got to keep it moving. It's incredibly difficult to get it back up and running again.
We'll discuss what it takes to make a successful negotiator and why courageous leaders are needed now more than ever.
She said that Tony thought he was effing Jesus.
Search Disorder wherever you get your podcasts.
What happened was, the Ukrainians have never been given the option of fighting a NATO-style war because they don't have air supremacy or air seniority or even air control 50% or nothing like it. They don't have F-16 jets. Ukraine should have said, the moment the big war started, or rather the moment when it became obvious that Ukraine was going to fight like fucking tigers, which they have done, then we needed to send a ton. Now, we needed to send everything all at the same time. 14 British tanks, they're good. I've actually hitched a ride on one when I went into Kosovo. 14 tanks is, British tanks is nothing. Something like 50 Leopard tanks from various bits and pieces of Europe have been sent. But that, again, it's nothing like enough.
Thank you for listening to this edition of Behind the Lines. I'm Arthur Snell. With attention now inevitably turning to the Middle East, Ukraine risks becoming Europe's forgotten war. But some people haven't forgotten it, not the least of which is John Sweeney, the man with the lucky orange hat, who's reporting from Kyiv as ever. I caught up with John to talk about Ukraine's situation, its counter-offensive, and the stalemate that it appears to have reached. And what lies ahead, a long winter of Russian bombardment. Here's John. So I'm seeing John on my screen now in his lucky orange hat. Welcome.
Wonderful to be with you, Arthur.
You're back in Kyiv once again after a bit of a spell in western bits of Europe. What's it like in Kyiv right now?
Listen, Arthur, I've always been, when the Russian army was 12 miles away, I was very optimistic that they couldn't take the city. As I kept on saying, the internet is still on, the electricity is still on, there are no Russian tanks in my streets, and I'm still wearing my lucky orange hat. But that was last year. Now the mood is gloomy. It's been gloomy since the summer, and I hesitated to report it because, remember, everything you say that is can cast a shadow on Ukrainian hopes is over-amplified by Russia's useful idiots and Russian bots and the whole backdrop to what's happening here in Ukraine is that Russian agents in the West amplify the Russian story and diminish the Ukrainian story. And so one has to keep a weather eye for that problem the whole time. But having said that, the mood here is gloomy. And I know you're the miserable bugger of the two of us, and I'm the eternal optimist. Well, I fear the tables have turned in that one does feel very gloomy here.
Yeah.
Let's try to understand what's happened there. I for what it's worth, I over a period of a few months, you know, now and then I'd speak to sort of government officials who, of course, are supportive of Ukraine, want to put the narrative out there that things are going well. But it seemed to me that increasingly they were struggling to say that the counteroffensive was really achieving what it wanted to achieve. And it feels as if in the last couple of weeks that has crystallized, and everyone from Zaluzhny himself, General Zaluzhny, the Ukrainian commander, is sort of acknowledging that basically they've been fought to a standstill down in the Donbass. Is that how it feels to you? You're obviously much closer to it.
Yeah, so there's two things. There is the failure of the counteroffensive and why, but let's start with what's happened.
Yeah.
And I first heard this from my pal Vlad Damchenko in the summer, I think it was June. And this is shortly after the counteroffensive had started, and he had a break from the front line. Remember, this is the guy, your listeners may not know, but he arrested me on day two for being a Russian spy. Do I look like a Russian spy? And he put up his machine gun. Folks, never have an argument with a Ukrainian with a loaded machine gun. Anyway,
good advice. Top tips from Mr. Sweeney here.
I was actually booked into the SBU, the Ukrainian intelligence, which is on day two of the big war, was not a healthy place to hang out in, I can tell you. And I wanted to say, come on, chaps, can you speed up this process, please? But that would have been foolish and counterproductive. So I kept my tongue, but it was annoying. And just before, he booked me in and, you know, Russian spy, Russian spy. I'm not a Russian spy. Google me, look me up. And then having booked me in, and so that there was no way we could reverse the military bureaucracy, it's kind of like getting a parking ticket, but with machine guns, right?
Yes.
He Googled me and he saw that I doorstepped Putin and I had challenged Trump, and Trump was so annoyed, Trump walked out of the interview. And he said, so you've challenged Putin, yes? And you've interviewed Trump, and Trump walks out, yes. And he looks at me and goes, I think you have an interesting story. Now, a couple of things about Vlad. He hitchhiked to Botswana during COVID.
Wow.
He was one of the protesters who stood up to the vicious pro-Russian Ukrainian riot police back in 2014 when they were defending a pro-Russian president who subsequently fled to Russia. And then he fought in the east in Donetsk for the battle for Donetsk airport. He was one of the cyborgs. And when the big war starts, he spent the first few days standing under the bridge at Irpin, helping old ladies with their dogs and cats walk across. So he's now in Ukrainian special forces. So as a courageous and brave and very funny Ukrainian, albeit one who arrested me for being a Russian spy, he's top dollar. And I saw him, I had a drink with him. He had a break from the front line. He's now in special forces. And I said, what's it like? And he said, it's bad. And my entire, you know, spirit dropped, because to hear it from him, it's bad. So what's happened is the Russians have caught up. They've got lots and lots of drones. They took a trench the other day and they found something like 12 packets of fresh Chinese drones waiting to be fired up. The numbers are incredibly, there's just so many of them. So what happens is they liberate a trench, and for some reason, Russian command, which is chaotic, doesn't twig this. So when there is a rotation out, the new people come in and they capture them or kill them. And they do this on repeat, like 4 or 5 times. But after a while, it becomes exhausting and they keep on killing them and it doesn't happen. And Vlad also had a friend with his who was, well, Vlad is his special forces. He moves around a lot. The other guy was in the Zaporizhia front, which is the spear head going south from Zaporizhia city towards Topmak. And the point is, if you get Topmak then you can put your artillery, which is good for around 30 kilometers, or the Grad stuff, and it can start interdicting or stopping friction-free traffic, carrying ammo, for example, to the front south of Kherson. I heard from a friend that Ukrainian high command wanted to take Topmak by mid-October. Here we are on 9th of November, and that hasn't happened. So yeah, their plan is running far behind, but also the losses. Now, and Zelensky said this himself, is during the Soviet invasion of Afghanistan, the Soviet war against Afghanistan, they lost 15,000 Soviet soldiers, and that was enough to be one of the big motors of the destruction of the Soviet Union, a failed and catastrophic war. Only 15,000 dead. Now, the Russian dead is disputed, but Ukrainians are saying something like 300,000 dead or so severely injured that they're as dead. And I think that number might be too high, but not out of the ballpark too high. But let's halve it and say it's 150,000 dead or horribly injured, hopelessly injured. That's, that's 10 times what they lost in Afghanistan under the Soviet Union. And it has no effect on Putin's machinery or Putin's mind. And so the problem is you're dealing with an enemy who is far more pitiless than Leonid Brezhnev.
Yeah.
Who doesn't care about losses. And Vlad's friend, who's in special forces and on this particular front, I said, do you think, and it's bad, we lost our armor. What happened was we were put into a trap. So they're moving ahead with the armor, and then the Russians shape a minefield. So as they progress, they get into a narrower and narrower funnel, and it's heavily, heavily mined. And the tanks, the Leopard tanks, and apparently a Challenger. I've heard that 4 Challenger tanks have been knocked out of commission, not just one. But we've only seen one, but there are another 3. They get smashed up. And then the Russians use artillery to smash the back of the column, causing a roadblock, and then everybody in the middle is doomed. And They did this on repeat. And I said to Vlad's friend, do you think, you know, you could do better? And he said, no, I think we had one shot and we lost it. And this was in the summer. And I didn't want to... I did a couple of video diaries reflecting this, and I got a lot of flack from Ukrainian supporters, understandably, but also, you know, what I'm supposed to do. I'm trying to tell the truth here as best I can and support Ukraine both at the same time. But I kind of wished it wasn't true. And by the way, one of the people who was with me, he was a fantastic chap called James, who was in the British Army, who drives ambulances from Britain to Ukraine supporting them, full of medical stuff, all of that. And James had been in the Iraq War, the first one. He's my age, 65. Anyway, when James goes, I say, "You do realize who that is?" And I said, "No." And I said, "That is Major James Hewitt."
Oh, yes. Not any old James.
Major James Hewitt, who, anyway, we all know about him. And he's a good man, a good bloke. But he, both James and I, were struck by the two boys, the two Ukrainian soldiers, that had a hard time. And essentially everybody I've spoken to since, and I've got a kind of range of sources, varying from Ukrainian supermodels to my friend Max, who runs a Buena Vista, who's pals with somebody high up in artillery, to pals who've got pals who are in high command, and everybody's saying the same. And actually, when I came back here, I said, one of my pals, how's it going? It's bad, stalemate. And I said stalemate, and then people slagged me off. And then pretty much the next day, both Zelensky, but this was his thoughts appeared in this article in Time, and then Zelensky wrote his piece in The Economist, stalemate, stalemate, stalemate. So why? And the reason for this is there is Western policy, which is essentially American policy, or the Americans are the only people in the game who've got enough materiel to shift the game. Have a policy, and it the first policy is we will defend Ukraine. Ukraine will not be defeated. Kyiv will survive. Semicolon, but we will not give Ukrainians enough stuff to secure victory.
Yeah,
and the second part is not articulated.
Yeah, I think that point you just made is so important. I sort of hinted at it earlier in the year, because it did seem to me that that was what was going on. The Americans, as you say, they definitely don't want Russia to win, but they don't want Russia to be defeated. And of course, if Russia is tied down in Europe with a very, very costly war, and that war is, it doesn't involve American troops, you know, fighting and dying, you can see if you take a very, very sort of cool and cynical view of the world, why that might suit them. But of course, you know, it doesn't suit Ukraine, because Ukraine can never join NATO, can never join the EU if a third of its country is under Russian occupation.
It's a fifth. It can't join NATO because NATO is a military alliance. It can get pretty close to the European Union, though, even but it feels difficult, but it could get close. But let's unpick the Western, the unarticulated Western policy. By the way, it's the American policy, but neither the Europeans or the British are doing enough to challenge it in any serious way, by which I mean we should be building armament factories and tanks factories and producing. By the way, I believe this. The problem is that it fails to understand the nature of Vladimir Putin and his success in poisoning the entire Western democratic system. And it fails to understand that people will say, oh, well, if Putin goes, you might be replaced with somebody worse. And I think that's foolish, because Putin is the subtlest and most intelligent tyrant, I think, certainly in my lifetime. And what he's done is he's used Russian gold, dark Russian gold, to buy influence and power and agents, people like, witting or unwitting, I think this gets me through the libel laws, if not all concerned deny any wrongdoing, but people like Trump and people like Nigel Farage and Aaron Banks, who have their own reasons, sure, but effectively they are supporting Russian goals, Kremlin goals. For example, the election of Donald Trump was a Kremlin goal because they knew that Hillary Clinton would be tough on them. And Trump was, you know, was a masseur with the baby oil, as far as the Kremlin is concerned. And this has caused terrible, terrible problems. And his anti, for example, the idea that America under Trump would secure a Ukrainian defeat and that Trump would withdraw from NATO, these are serious possibilities. Serious possibilities. Equally, Brexit, you know, a divided Europe, a Europe at loggerheads fighting itself. This is also a Kremlin goal. And then there's China. So I think the critical anxiety driving the second unarticulated part of the American policy, we do not want to give the Ukrainians enough material to defeat the Russians, is driven by chaos in Russia if Putin falls. And chaos in Russia, what the Americans fear is an Iraq 2.0. They fear a Islamist Chechens, for example, getting hold of a rogue nuke and threatening the entire Western world, etc., etc., etc. So this anxiety is the, rather than a crude cynicism of, you know, we like it that the Russians are entangled in this endless forever war, it is more fear of the consequences of a Ukrainian victory. The problem is, for me, fear of a bad tomorrow leads to a terrible today. Because, I don't know if you read it, but there was a very interesting article in the New Yorker the other day about a stagnant China. And the closing phrase is, the question is a stagnant, I'm from memory, is a stagnant China more or less likely to go to war with the United States?
Yeah.
And after I finished the article, and essentially it's citing how a whole series of Chinese oligarchs have disappeared, along with various generals, along with anybody who's either got capital or power in the Chinese political system, or military power or military office in some rank. How anybody who's remotely critical of Chairman Xi has been disappeared. And when I read the article, it struck me that the thriving engine of the Chinese economy is being jammed by totalitarian sand. And so the Chinese economy is actually not going up, but it's faltering or going down.
Yeah, indeed.
So what do you do? What story do you tell your China's a billion people? As they head towards poverty, you say, listen, our enemies are against us. We have to fight our enemies. We go.
Yeah. And there is, of course, that also plays into this idea all around Taiwan that, you know, Xi Jinping tries to create a kind of false urgency that, you know, time is running out for us to complete the reunification. Now, of course, when he says reunification, that normally implies an enormous amount of, obligation forced on the Taiwanese. And again, you know, a country that is self-confident, growing, its economy is flourishing, all the rest of it. But just let's go back a bit to the Ukraine front. And I guess, prior to the start of this big counteroffensive, we all knew that the Ukrainians had come to Europe. They were going to get trained in the best NATO techniques, and then they were going to get the famous Leopard tanks. And people like you and me were loudly saying, you know, Germany has to be generous with the tanks and other European countries. And obviously the UK donated some of its tanks, but it didn't work. Now, is that, do we think, because actually the tactics were wrong? Is it maybe that the NATO way of fighting wouldn't do very well in a war against Russia, which in itself is quite a troubling thought? Or is it, what are there some other factors in play here?
Yeah. By the way, I want to talk about all of that, but just going back a moment to China, the thing I'm scared of is that Putin has managed to kind of mentor Xi. And you know what you've got to do, mate? If you want to stay in power, you've got to lock up your oligarchs.
Yeah.
And then you've got to fight the enemy.
Yeah.
And everything Xi is doing feels like a copy. Like, locking up the oligarchs is like Putin locked up Khodorkovsky. And then what happens is the West goes, oh, that's not quite right. but it doesn't hit. There are no serious consequences. And yeah. then what you do is you know, China's doing, it's messing around in the South China Sea, these funny fake islands, pushing on its neighbors, waiting to see who's weak and waiting to see the response. And I worry that the Chinese, Xi, will actually, I think the Taiwanese aren't stupid. If they align with China, then that's their democracy gone. That's their ability to read the books they want to read. I mean, like, you know, the idea of if you're a Chinese scientist and you have to spend a third of your working day reading the works of Chairman Xi, which is what's happening, you know, it's bad, bad. So I don't think they're going to vote for tyranny. I think what's going to happen is that tyranny will come and take them in the middle of a contested American election. So that's one of the consequences of American fear of tomorrow, of a bad tomorrow, is leading to a worse today. But to return to your point, what happened was the Ukrainians have never been given the option of fighting a NATO-style war because they don't have air supremacy or air seniority or even air control 50% or nothing like it. They don't have F-16 jets. They don't have enough runways to control it. I've actually, I haven't seen this, but one of my pals has. Suddenly the traffic, you're on a big motorway going from Kyiv westwards to Lviv. Suddenly all the traffic is stopped. And the jet, it's a Ukrainian jet, lands and then goes off and then hides in a bunker in the forest. And that's an active Ukraine. Now, you can't do that with F-16. So there are lots of logistical problems. But Ukraine should have said, the moment the big war started, or rather the moment when it became obvious that Ukraine was going to fight like fucking tigers, which they have done, then we needed to send a ton. Now, we needed to send everything all at the same time. Britain, for example, I've been, I went and gave a talk to the King's Royal Hussars, lovely chaps, very funny. And they'd given seven of their Challenger tanks, another regiment had given seven of them, 14 British Challenger tanks. The Russians have lost 2,000 tanks so far, I think. The Russians have got another 8,000.
Yeah.
Now, 14 British tanks, they're good. I've actually hitched a ride on one when I went into Kosovo along with NATO in 99. But 14 tanks is... British tanks is nothing. Something like 50 Leopard tanks from various bits and pieces of Europe have been sent. But that, again, it's nothing like enough.
Yeah.
So you don't have, so did Ukraine fail to fight a NATO war? No. Ukraine actually has done extremely well fighting with not enough kit.
Yeah.
But there is nothing like, and actually the Ukrainians, because it's their land and their morale is high, because no soldier's morale is better than when you're fighting for your land. By the way, this is a lesson that the Israeli Defense Force are learning. I would hesitate to say, I've been to Gaza twice. It's a lesson they're going to learn. You're defending your territory. You fight very, very hard. And the Ukrainians are trying to take it back. They've been fighting very hard. But they don't have air cover or air seniority or air supremacy. NATO fights only ever with air supremacy.
Yeah.
Don't have that. They don't even have a quality of ammunition, a quality of tanks or armored cars or anything like it. The Western stuff's better, but there isn't enough of it in enough quality to make
to make the difference. Yeah.
And then you know, there are various horror stories. Like, for example, I think the standard shell is 150 millimeter.
Yeah.
The problem is that there is a kind of commission inside NATO, and it never got the various NATO countries to properly standardize this. So that, I'm hypothecating here, but Italian shells work in Italian guns and not in other guns. Now, that may be unfair on the Italian.
No, that's right, John. It's extraordinary. We think NATO is a standard. It turns out it isn't, you know, and if we were fighting a war, we'd probably figure that out really quickly. And it's sad that it had to be the Ukrainians who had to learn that.
So the Ukrainians, the problem with the Ukrainians is they're utterly dependent on the West's generosity.
Yeah.
So for them to say, listen, you stupid schmucks, you're sending us kit which we can't use. It's not interchangeable.
Yeah.
So we have a terrible supply problem all the time.
Yeah.
But you can't say that. It was a powerful interview with the former head of the Russia desk at the Pentagon, who said, Trump's policy is bad, bad, bad. But Biden's policy of drip feeding Ukraine with military aid is abhorrent.
Hmm.
And again, this is all part of it's all part of Western weakness.
Yeah.
So that one of my friends said, I do not think that North Koreans would have sent 1 million artillery shells to Ukraine without the Chinese saying, yes, you can do this. And I think the Chinese are only doing this because they can see that Ukraine is, after a heroic defense last year, is now in trouble.
Yeah.
And so, and by the way, Hamas attacked and did their evil massacre of Israel on October the 7th, which just so happens to be Putin's birthday. And so while the entire world attention will focus is on the horrors in Israel-Palestine, we're not seeing any focus on Ukraine, and many more people have died in Ukraine than will die in Israel-Palestine. But also the other thing is that the Chinese and their proxies, the North Koreans, are helping Putin in a far more effective way than the West.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
The next, the gossip is, the next thing from Pyongyang is going to be rockets. Now, the Russians have run out of rockets. I mean, there hasn't been an effective Russian rocket attack on Kyiv for months.
Yeah.
But every time there is one, then the Ukrainians use up the air defense. Guess what the Republicans are doing? They're saying no more aid to Ukraine. It's a waste of time. Oh, these are the MAGA extremists. But effectively, they can stop and halt aid to Ukraine, it seems.
Absolutely. So
if North Korean rockets start coming to Russia, and I think that highly likely, given the lack of push, the lack of effective pushback from the West to North Korea's entry on the supply side, on Russia's side, then you can start seeing Kyiv getting hammered again because it doesn't have enough Patriot missiles to keep this swarm of Iranian Shahids and North Korean rockets away.
Yeah.
And then what happens? Then you can see, the mood here is bleak. People are angry and upset. My friends in the Ukrainian army are exhausted. And you can see the pressure growing on the Zelensky government. So what do we do? What do we do with 40 million Ukrainian refugees? Or do we do the other thing and say, hold on, this is bad. We're now going to make a policy across the West that every shell must fit every tank, every NATO cannon.
Yeah.
That we start opening up, we start building tank factories and ammunition factories.
Yeah.
Not just in the United States, but in Britain too. And we're serious about this because the Western world is in trouble. Ukraine is just getting it first, but all of us in trouble.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's certainly the issue of where the US is seems to me very difficult because, as obviously listeners will be well aware, they had this near shutdown in the government and then effectively the Congress is shut down, no speaker. And now they've got the speaker, this new speaker. He doesn't want to give anything to Ukraine. He's obsessed with Israel for sort of, which is, you know, of course, America should support its allies, but that he wants to support Israel because of what it tells him in the Bible, you know, is this is very kind of strange worldview. And so Ukraine now does have to rely on Europe. And I'm sure you're aware, John, you know, that Europe is now actually sending more stuff than America is. But as you say, it's not enough.
I didn't know that. Is that right? Well, right now?
Yes, right now. So the Europe line has crossed the America line in terms of sort of supplies of weapons and aid. And what's interesting, I think, is that, but that doesn't, you know, on one level, you could say, well, good for Europe. But actually, as you rightly say, Europe doesn't have the capacity. You know, 14 Challenger tanks is a drop in the ocean. The shells that don't match the different cannons and so on. So Europe needs to recognize, it seems to me, that America isn't necessarily coming back. You know, there's two questions there. You know, one, can Trump win an election? He possibly could. But even if he doesn't, you know, Biden's got so many other things on his plate. You know, that if we want to support Ukraine, it's on us. But I guess it's worth talking a bit about the Russians, because in a way, the first part of the war, that when you were in Kyiv, I remember we spoke and the Russians were, you know, you were in Vauxhall, the Russians were in Edgware, actually that part of the story was a story of incompetence, that the famous traffic jam and all the rest of it. But it feels as if the Russians have got two things right. One is a willingness to throw away their young men. And of course, I hesitate to say that's right, but it's right for their war. And actually, people underestimate how many they're willing to kill. And then the other thing seems that actually they have proved to be what people didn't think they were, which is they are a learning force. You know, they've learned from their early mistakes and they've now got a kind of trench warfare that they can sustain and which can grind down the Ukrainians.
Yeah, so that's exactly what Vlad said in the summer. They've got better. They've adapted, so that they now have more Chinese-made drones than. And remember, Chinese have been careful. They're worried about sanctions, but they don't care about their proxies, North Korea, or rather, they're letting North Korea do the dirty work and Iran as well.
Yeah.
So, but essentially, the Russian killing machine is learning and adapting. It's a bit like the moment in Jurassic Park when you realize the velociraptors are kind of they're learning.
Yeah.
I think one of the there's a kind of big game hunter. He realizes he's been trapped by the velociraptor, and he goes, "Good girl, you know, well done." before the horrible dinosaur gobbles him up. And that's what's happening here. Now, what happened was, essentially, with the big war, they stole about a quarter of Ukraine. And last year, the Ukrainians were able, by hammering away, to get Kharkiv Oblast back and Kherson back. And this was a critical moment where Western supply should have been massive. And instead it wasn't at all. And the Russians, having pulled back, were able to, under Sorovikin, the butcher of Syria, were able to put up something called the Sorovikin line. And essentially what it is three lines of minefields, three lines of trenches, three lines of guns pointed at flanks. And these are very, very hard to penetrate. And remember, the drones mean there's no surprise now in this war. And both sides have got drones. The Russians have now got more drones, according to my friends, than the Ukrainians. So what the Ukrainians are having to do is to fight trench by trench, but they're fighting a trench warfare. They're fighting a trench war against an army and a society and a dictatorship that doesn't care about loss of life.
Yeah.
And so the latest word, for example, is the average age of the Ukrainian army is 43. Now, this is awful because it means is they're running out of young men, or they've run out of young men, which is why Zelensky was so, you read what he writes and you read his interview in The Economist and why the impact of that is so bleak. Unless we have some technological big advance, which the West can do this in scale. It just has to produce an awful lot of stuff and deliver it effectively and in a timely fashion. And this story could change. But for the moment, Ukraine is on the back foot with American aid beginning to falter. Now, I want to see how the Republicans, the sensible Republicans, will deal with their MAGA colleagues when Ukraine, I hope to God this doesn't happen, but if Ukraine loses a city, for example, one of the cities out in the east like Kupiansk or God forbid, Kharkiv or something like this, and then you've got millions of refugees moving west, moving to Kyiv, how the sensible Republicans will deal with their MAGA colleagues and say, what are you doing? This is the consequence of our failure to do this. And the separate nightmare is, what's going to happen with Trump? Now, I saw the American elections the other day, and essentially Main Street America doesn't like the MAGA's absurd views on abortion. And so there's a little bit of hope there. But there will be a lot of chaos. And I think it's fatuous to assume that the new America is going to be a reliable ally for us. And we have to act as though we can't trust on American military power to protect us.
Yeah.
It's a devastating thing to say, but I think that's realistic.
No, I think you're right. And I think if you look, as you say, that obviously we're speaking literally a day after they've had the election results, and the Democrats have done pretty well and they do keep doing well. But if you look at the presidential approval for Biden, it's very low. If you look at the fact that he's obviously, I don't buy into this thing that he's got dementia or whatever. I mean, he's an elderly man, but he seems pretty switched on. But an elderly man, as we all know, can have one trip up or any little accident or anything like that. And Trump seems to have this extraordinary ability, driven. I guess it's hate. Hate's an amazing fuel because it works for him. It works for Putin. It seems to keep driving him on. And Trump doesn't look like, he may be losing his marbles, but I think he lost his marbles in his 20s, probably, and he's never got them back.
No, he's got. So Trump hasn't lost his marbles. Trump is a vicious narcissist and this is what's quite fascinating and weird. For somebody who's so self-obsessed, he has an amazing instinct to smell at other people's fear and weakness.
Yes.
Again, like the velociraptor in the kitchen scene in Jurassic Park. And like Putin, he can smell weakness.
Yeah.
And then Trump goes for it. And what's happening is that Putin and Xi are using our own beautiful open societies against us in an incredibly effective way. And we keep on letting them get away with it. Now, you were trying to steer, I think, the conversation towards Russia.
Yes.
And I was very taken with what Owen Matthews, and everybody should read Owen's great book. What's it called? I've forgotten. I'm going gaga. Mine is called Killer in the Kremlin.
But yes, your book is very good, and it's called Killer in the Kremlin. His book, it's called Overreach. Overreach.
Yeah, Overreach, yeah. So what Owen told you, and I, by the way, so you know, my lovely landlady, I've got a lovely flat here in Kyiv, which I rent. And come in the summer, come on a picnic. We've got a little dasher by the river. They're well off, but they're not fantastically well off. It's a nice little place. just before I go swimming in the river, for some reason, it's kind of almost African. It's very hot. It's rather beautiful. And I find myself just turning my head back to the gang and saying, are the crocodiles? And okay, folks, you know, it snows here. There are no crocodiles in the
The famous alligators.
When her dad did the barbecue, it's just kind of like, he gave me this sort of chunk of meat and said, this is crocodile. So, but the big number one question at that my landlady's barbecue was, what about Trump?
Yeah.
So everybody in Ukraine, or everybody smart in Ukraine, wants to know, is Trump going to win?
Yeah.
They're afraid. They're very, very afraid. And the point is, he may not win, but he can generate so much chaos in the American political system that America is frozen at the very moment when Russia may be on the front foot and Xi may seize, you know, as I said earlier, Xi may seize this opportunity. But the other thing that when the Owen Matthews, he's coming out to Kyiv hopefully soon, but when he said to you, I was struck by, you know, the man in the Kremlin, the Tsar will only fall if on three conditions. One is that the economy is a total mess.
Yep.
And the economy is in trouble, but it's not a total mess.
Not yet, no.
Two is that government has ceased to function effectively, and that is not true. And three, there is a serious alternative to the Tsar.
And that last one is really...
It's really not true. Like Prigozhin had an accident.
He did, yes.
Airplane, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So, by the way, I'm very confident that Putin has a double. I can actually identify him pretty well. He is a little bit smaller than Putin. His jaw is more flabby than Putin because Putin's Botox and cosmetic surgery. His jaw is, or rather his underjaw, his neck is smoother than it should be for a man of his age, but the double hasn't had that. So the jaw and the underneck looks flabby.
They've skimped on the plastic surgery for the double.
Yes, and the suits are cheaper.
Ah,
so
typical cutting corners, you know.
But the real tell is that Putin, after COVID, has a morbid fear of people whose breathing, whose germs he cannot control. He's happy. You'll see him close up with a couple of the generals who he knows, you know, he's looking at their, his spies will look at their charts all the time. But he, you know, from Macron and the long table just before the big war, the National Security Council, where he humiliated one of his underbosses, like Don Corleone.
Yeah.
What's his name?
Narishkin, the SVR guy.
Yeah.
Narishkin, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But the point is, everybody was 20 feet away. And then when he gave a kind of nationalist rally in Moscow, Russia, 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 about a month after the war started, he's on his own. Normally, you get some fancy lady with a bouquet of flowers for this bouquet of cunts. Can I say that? I just did. You get something like this, and that didn't happen because Putin's there on his own. So the real Putin has a morbid fear of other people. When Putin, I've written about this for my patrons, and it's all free. Just click on it; you can read it now. Another Putin, for example, went to the Dagestan, southern Russian town of Derbent, and he's hobnobbing.
Right,
it's not the real guy because
right.
He doesn't. You know, he's hobnobbing. He kisses a baby. He kisses a student. He's shaking people's hands. That's the double.
And presumably, it's the dummy that goes to Mariupol of all places.
Yes, exactly. The other day, after the Hamas attack on Putin's birthday, the double, there's no Putin. And the double pops up and says very little at a kind of Moscow Space Control Center. And he's very close to these nerdy rocket engineers in a way that, oh, that's the double. But I was, and then what clocked it for me was a day later or 2 days later, the real Putin pops up and talks about Hamas and Israel-Palestine. But he's got a cough. So the reason they sent the double out was because they didn't want to have Putin respond to the Hamas attack and Israel's reaction while he was coughing and wheezing and sneezing, because he's a Superman. But, and the other thing is the double is shorter, like Medvedev. But the bad news is that Putin, the real Putin, is alive and kicking. He's functioning. His economy is in serious trouble, but not crippling trouble, because Western sanctions have not been effective. Because we actually, we are still burning Europe, Russia. Europe is still burning Russian gas and oil. We're allowing it, we are delivering tons more bits and pieces, conductors, semiconductors, to the stands, and the stands are exporting them into Russia. We are not policing sanctions properly. And there is no opposition to Putin because everybody is dead or locked up. So realistically, we've got to look and see that Putin is alive and kicking. His war is going well. He is on the front foot. China is seeing Western weakness and sniffing the wind and thinking, yeah, well, maybe let's take Taiwan because the West aren't going to do anything serious about it. It's bleak, Arthur, it's bleak.
We're speaking in early November, and of course, there's a long winter ahead of you, ahead of us. It's very important that people start to kind of annoy their politicians in Western Europe and say that we need to support Ukraine more, because I can't see any other way that this gets better.
Yes, so we need to do three things. We need to police sanctions properly. And build on them and go for people and lock people up who break sanctions. Not just a slap on the wrist, not just an article in the papers. But for example, our intelligence services, they know this stuff, but they need to, you know, we need to read it in the Sunday Times or whatever. This is who owns what. This is how they're being broken. And then we need to go and lock up the people who are breaking the sanctions so that they work more effectively. And we need to stop, we need to, and some of this involves suffering. If we stop burning Russian oil and gas, then prices and gas will go up. Yes, I understand that. But there is a cost of living crisis in the West and in Britain. There is a cost of dying crisis here in Ukraine. Now, the reason I'm saying this isn't just because I'm some crazy Ukrainian nationalist. I'm not. I'm somebody who says that if Russia wins in Ukraine, or has some kind of victory in Ukraine, which is more likely than not at the moment, then we're next. And I don't want my, you know, my kids or my grandchildren to face face the prospect of a real war. And that becomes more likely if we don't do something. Secondly, we need to start opening up defense industry. And I mean, it's a horrible thing to say, I don't want to do this, but we have to. We have to make shells, ammunition, tanks, guns, machine guns. We have to build up the British Army from its basically skeletal state at the moment into something that that's got mass. Doesn't have mass. It's too skinny. It's been starved. It needs to be looked after properly. So we've got to spend a serious amount of money on defence and on that. And the third thing is, we've got to start spelling this out to people. You assume democracy, you assume everything's going to be good. Don't. Look at, you know, read that article in the New Yorker about China. Read the article by Zelushny in The Economist. And, you know, and this is not good news. The Western world is on the back front, back foot. The dictators are on the front foot. They're using our democracy against us. They have witting or unwitting agents like Trump who are doing their bidding. and our entire machinery is not fit for purpose. We are losing the argument. And I mean, 1989, I reported on both the Romanian and Czech revolutions.
Yeah.
Bliss was it to be alive in that. What's the line from Wordsworth? You're better educated than I am.
Bliss was it to be alive in that dawn, and to be young was very heaven.
There we go. There's that's an expensive education going for you.
Yeah, yeah.
Stop it, John. Stop it. Daffodils. Anyway, never mind. So it was glorious and beautiful. It was a beautiful moment in my life. That moment is long past. And it feels like the dictators are back. It feels like 1938, Arthur.
John, thank you for joining me from Kyiv.
Thank you. Oh, and Vladimir Putin, do fuck off.
Almost as soon as I'd had that rather downbeat discussion with John, there was important news from the front lines in Ukraine, and some of that news is positive. So I got back in touch with him for a quick epilogue discussion. We recorded that today, the 17th of November. Welcome back, John.
Hey, Hope. It's as if you've never been away, Arthur. So the good news is, and it's all been a bit bleak here, but the good news is that the very brave and very gutsy boys and girls of the Ukrainian army, particularly the Marines, have managed to get a bridgehead on the opposite, what we call the left bank, because the way people in this part of the world look at their rivers is they look at it from the source. So in a way which I find slightly weird, but never mind. So the left bank is the eastern bank, the Russian-occupied bank, of the big mighty Dnipro. This is opposite Kherson.
Yeah.
And the place I'm about to mispronounce called something like Krinky, which is where they managed, and the river's wide here, you know, it's a big old river, and they've managed to not only get soldiers across in little boats, but they've also, the Russians have reported at least one Humvee's been blown up, which means that they're using bigger boats to get the Humvees across and maybe other stuff too. And the Russians, and what's funny about this is the Russians put out an announcement a couple of days ago saying that they are restructuring their soldiers. And restructuring is a Kremlin word which you can decode as they're going backwards.
Yes.
And then the announcement was deleted and everything disappeared. But of course, Ukrainians and their friends were absolutely onto this. So when this first happened, I was worried that it was just going to be a marginal thing and it didn't have big roots, and the Russians will be able to knock them out. That is still possible.
Yeah.
But the longer this bridgehead has lasted, the better. And it tells you, I think, two things. The first of which is the Ukrainians are very good at buggering up Russian logistics, in particular with long-range rocket artillery systems, which can, what it does is they blow up the ammo dumps, so the Russians keep on having to put the ammo dumps further and further back. And that means that every time they put ammo in a lorry, it has to go much further.
And
the first moment of this was HIMARS, and that impacted very successfully for the Ukrainians and badly for the Russians last year. This time, they've been given Storm Shadow missiles by the British. There aren't many of them, but effectively, they've had to move their range of their ammo dumps. They were at 40 miles away from the front line. They're now at something like 80 miles away because of the range of the Storm Shadows.
Yeah.
So this means, I think, this is the best possible explanation for the Ukrainian success and the fact that the Russians haven't been able to flush them out. The second point is a simple one, and actually there's a team from ABC Australia, Steve Canoni. He's a great reporter, and he's written a rather good book about the Church of Scientology in Australia. He's not a fan. Anyway, you can imagine we're pals, which we are. He's just been to the front line, and he told me the spirit of the Ukrainians was really strong. Yeah. And again, risking this kind of, you know, a big river crossing this time of year, that's a hairy thing to do. And that tells you that the Ukrainian fighting spirit is still strong.
Yeah. Well, that's great to hear. And it's important that people understand the scale of this. I've been looking at the maps. The river at Kherson, we're talking something a bit like the Bristol Channel, not like the Thames in London. You know, it's a big operation. And the other thing then is the geography. So for those who are less familiar with the map of Ukraine, this is, if you like, to the west side of Crimea. So it's a way to cut off the Russians sort of base in Crimea from the western side, where, of course, a lot of the operations earlier in Ukraine's offensive have been on that eastern side. Nonetheless, we are now moving to the winter, which we obviously talked about in our bigger conversation. But just in closing, what's the feeling in the big cities? Obviously, you're in Kyiv, where it feels as if Russia will be planning to spend another season of pounding them with air raids and so on.
Yeah, I mean, we're all expecting a swarm. So what happens is there hasn't been a big attack on Kyiv since May, a big and effective attack where what you do, so what they do is they throw one point in May, there were 6 hypersonic missiles and 12 cruise missiles, and then another 80 Shahed drones. And what the drones do is it's a swarm, and it's very difficult for Ukrainian air defense to knock out everything because so much is coming them all at one go.
Yeah.
Now, what we're expecting is at some point when and it's starting to get cold here, that they will attack both the big cities, but also the power stations, which keep the heat on in the winter. And it'll be a horrible swarm attack. It'll happen on a clear day because all the fancy rockets, the cruise missiles, don't need this. I understand that some of the more simple drones, the Iranian ones, they need good weather. For example, the rivers are a bloody good way of geolocating. And so what you want is like a full moon or a clear sky, at least a clear sky, to see so the drones can see where you're going. The good news is it's slightly muggy and not muggy, but it's cloudy today. So it's probably not going to be tonight. We're kind of like, it's a kind of drone, like there was a bomber's moon in the Second World War, and it feels there's a kind of drone moon now. So every now and then the air raids go off here, the air raid sirens go off, Putin's lullaby, and I'm used to it, but every time it sends a shiver on my spine.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Behind the Lines. If you never want to miss another episode, click subscribe right now. We've got some great guests coming up in the next couple of weeks. This episode was presented and produced by me, Arthur Snell, and the theme tune is by Matty Benbrook.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey, folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.